Hello and welcome back to another episode of Elite Medical School. And I'm so fortunate today to be joined by both Dr. I and our good friend here, Dr. P. How are you gentlemen today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Dr. T?
I'm just fiddling with my Winky. So I'm doing okay. Thank you. So shall we, you know what, we can just jump into things if you'd like. We were hoping today to talk a little bit about the pandemic. No, we're not talking about COVID. We're talking about obesity. So obesity has reached pandemic levels. It's a scourge on our society. And, apropos of COVID, I think it's probably the number two predictor of mortality and morbidity besides age for COVID. But anyhow, that's an aside. Are you guys excited to talk about overweight and obesity?
I'm excited to talk about this pogdemic.
There's an upside to everything.
I've flirted with obesity most of my life, so it hits close to home.
I mean, I've been in the obese BMI range before, about a few years ago.
I've always been in the obese BMI range, but I don't really consider the BMI the official.
Are you obese? Is your BMI greater than 30?
Oh, sorry.
You're overweight.
I have a BMI of 46.
Extreme obesity, formerly known as morbid obesity. Class 3.
No.
Metastatic obesity.
Have you been feeling morbid?
I've definitely been feeling morbid. And I've been eating morbidly as well. No, I have a BMI and not that high. But
probably overweight.
It's always been overweight for sure.
I have the appearance of a long-bodied alien, an Alpha Centaurian, and yet I'm considered
Zeta Reticulum,
and yet I'm considered overweight. But anyhow, that's
really
I look up to body positive models like Ashley Graham.
Okay, but you also said you ate like 8 Twinkies every night, something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, I'm definitely caloric. But I think it's fair to say, in our small sample here, that just about everyone is overweight or obese. It's a serious problem. And metabolic disorders such as type 2 diabetes are gateway diseases and certainly remove quality life years off many of your patients. So this is a super important topic that I think is often sort of swept under the rug because it's a sensitive issue. So we're going to deal with it in an insensitive way and try to get over the PC bullshit, man. And hopefully we'll retain some of the treatment modalities for obesity. So why don't we start off with some definitions and maybe comment on the utility of those indices for defining obesity.
BMI, as we were discussing earlier, that's body mass index, calculated as weight in kilograms divided by height, which is in meters squared. And that will give you a ratio that you can use that will fall into a certain morbidly obese class. So some values to remember: if your BMI is under 18.5, that's considered underweight, something that you should remember for eating disorders, as it's part of the DSM criteria is the BMI. Normal range is 18.5 to 24.9. Then 25 to 29.9 is overweight. 30 to 34.9 is obesity class 1. 35 to 39.9 is class 2, and 40 and above, that's extreme obesity with an X.
Taking obesity to the extreme. And so these categories are relevant. I'm sure they've been sort of validated in terms of disease outcomes. But they're also relevant for your patients. when you consider aggressive interventions and also in terms of insurance coverage, which is more relatable to our American listeners. But for example, you know, things like bariatric surgery, candidacy may be determined by obesity status. So locally, folks that are extremely obese may qualify without condition, whereas those in the class 2 range that is greater than 35 may need a comorbidity such as diabetes. So as flawed as BMI may be, I'm not fat, I'm just big boned type of attitude, as flawed as this classification system may be, there are clinical implications and it's used clinically as well.
Right. And I mean, a lot of the time when patients come in and they are classified as extreme obesity, a lot of the time they're actually bodybuilders where they have so much mass that it sets them over the edge.
Most of the time, I would say. Yeah.
Most of the time, they're actually very active, very healthy individuals. As we mentioned before, type 2 diabetes, that's certainly a risk that you'll be watching out for. We're also going to be worried about coronary artery disease, as well as stroke, hypertension as well. Dyslipidemia is going to be common. We'll get into that, some of the LDL and HDL in it later. With our bones, we're going to be worried about osteoarthritis, and then gallbladder disease, as well as non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. We'll be screening for that as well, as a lower back pain from a lot of the weight that these individuals are carrying around. Congestive heart failure will be another complication we'll be watching out for. And a variety of cancers are also, one would be at higher risk of certain cancers if they are obese as well. So certainly a wild amount of potential medical complications with obesity as an independent factor.
Yeah. Yeah, so suffice it to say that it's a gateway disease and it's a huge problem, highly prevalent in North America. You know, roughly 20% of the population is obese, and an even greater percent. I think it's now tipped over 50% are overweight adults. Perhaps that's no surprise. Unfortunately, there's some groups that are more afflicted than others, and that's a huge issue, particularly from a a metabolic perspective in terms of guidelines in food intake, that, you know, suggestions around daily carbohydrate intake, you know, for example, 300 grams of carb being applicable to people of all ethnicities is probably inappropriate and doing harm. So bringing awareness to your practice, especially with minority groups, is important. The pediatric population, obesity is increasing among pediatrics as well. So, you know, seeing diabetes even in 18-year-olds, it's quite astonishing. So this is a highly, highly prevalent, sort of a taboo, subject. And for that reason, we're afraid of talking about it and probably putting people at harm as a result. So that was sort of a discussion around epidemiology. Now, why don't we talk about what causes obesity? Dr. P, perhaps you could field this question. What do you think is the root cause of obesity?
Well,
what's the proximal cause of being fat?
Well, it's metabolic imbalance. Like, people eat mostly the same diet by and large across the world, but some people just digest food very quickly and are very effective at assimilating energy, and others are fortunate and have much slower metabolism.
Uh-huh. So I commented that highly speculative, politically correct answer is probably the way a lot of people look at it, and obviously there is some truth to that. Certainly lots of variability in metabolic rates. But I think the frank and honest answer is that too much food, too many calories in and not enough calories out is the proximal cause of obesity. And for most individuals, especially folks that are older, you know, over the age of 50, it's too many calories in. You know, simply speaking, the amount of exercise that you need to do to lose weight, you yourself, let's say you get on the treadmill and burn, you know, 150 calories after your 15 minute jaunt. It's like, oh my goodness, that's a half a muffin. Like, you know, that's a muffin. How could I possibly lose weight? And you could consider your morbidly obese elderly patients with knee pain, that it's virtually impossible. So I think it's fair to say that too many calories in or too much food, too much McDonald's is the cause of obesity.
Certainly the overeating, the frequent eating, the high calorie diets, we're going to be, those are certainly going to bulk up our patients. I would say that there certainly are cultural differences in terms of diet, and furthermore socioeconomic differences in sort of what type of food people will be eating, how much time they have to eat certain foods. This will certainly be like an apt answer on your exams, including the biopsychosocial perspective when it comes to some of the differentials for obesity. You also want to consider drugs, drug use. I don't know what kind of drugs really make you fat.
Syrup. Any psychotics, for sure.
Oh, well, antipsychotics, yeah. I was thinking more in terms of substance use.
Screen for alcoholism.
Alcoholism, you
know, calorie dense. Any psychotics, untreated hypothyroidism, untreated PCOS, untreated diabetes or overtreated diabetes, unnecessary insulin, especially in older groups, equivalent or tends to promote weight gain. So there are a number of medications that can cause it. Steroids like prednisone,
yeah. Cushing syndrome, same vein. We want to watch for that, and hypothyroidism, as well as any hypogonadism as well for our small peckered patients.
Yeah. And I think there's inconsistent evidence as relates to menopause. But I think that's a sort of an active area of research. Definitely postmenopausal women will have changes in body distribution of fat that can be, upsetting for them. So those are all important considerations. Sleep apnea is another one, and it's sort of a feed forward, cycle there. So in terms of, the most common cause, which is too many calories in, and by definition, if you restrict calories in, you will lose weight. The goal for most patients that you're going to provide is on the order of a 500 calorie deficit. So, you know, and again, the food guide, the fact that the food guide, your national food guide, unless you're from some, you know, ethnically, for all of our Finnish and Japanese listeners, perhaps your food guide is widely applicable, but for anyone from a multi-ethnic country, it's probably inappropriate to use such a one-size-fits-all approach. But anyhow, let's say that a food guide is recommending on the order of 2,000 calories a day, 50% of which are carbs, you know, on the order of 300 grams of carbs. In terms of a weight loss goal, you're going to recommend that patients aim for a caloric deficit of 500 kilocal. So that may be achieved for some through exercise. I think that's a small minority, quite frankly. But for most, it's going to be a dietary a deficit of about 500 calories. And that should, for many people, result in a weight loss on the order of a half a kilogram to a kilogram a week, or, you know, 1 to 2 pounds, roughly. So that's sort of the trajectory that's useful for lots of folks. And I think it's probably beyond the scope of this podcast to go into the various diets, but suffice it to say that there is evidence for low calorie diets. I'm not, low carbohydrate diets. I'm not endorsing, you know, a ketogenic diet particularly, but for example, Atkins diet has demonstrated reproducible weight loss. And a lot of, you know, speculation, again, you're tons of information out there. I encourage you to explore it. But a lot of the speculation around fad diets is if there's a major caloric source, such as carbs, that you can identify and eliminate, you're going to lose weight. So rather than being, you know, one energy source that determines weight loss, if there's some easy way to eliminate a certain amount of calories, you will lose weight. So for example, some folks may choose, you know, a green only diet and only eat green things. They're likely going to lose weight because it's challenging and limiting to find only green foods. Right. So decreasing calories in on the order of 500 to 1,000 kilocalories per day should result in, you know, on the order of a half a kilogram to a kilogram of weight loss per week.
There was actually a JAMA article that was released in 2005 that took a look at a wide range of commercial diets. It was a study of about 160 participants, so not the biggest study, but basically their finding was that that for long-term weight loss, maintenance of weight loss, it's not so much the diet that matters. What makes the largest impact is how adherent are they to whatever diet it is that they are on. As long as, you know, you choose that green diet and you stick to it, then you'll keep the weight off. But if you're bouncing between diets, getting discouraged, yeah, you're not going to have a good time with the scale there.
Absolutely. So that's helpful. And you know, patients sort of looking for the holy grail in terms of a diet, it may be a disappointing search for them. Dr. P, as I understand it, you only eat crickets in terms of protein. Is that correct?
Crickets? No. I mostly eat McDouble's Junior Chickens.
Yeah. The McDouble special.
Yeah.
two McDouble's, two Junior Chickens, and large fries, and then a snack on the side, which you know, you can get like apple pie or maybe another McDouble. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, but I was thinking in terms of the protein. It's mostly the McDoubles, the Junior Chickens. I'm trying to think what else. For my life, anyways, Dr. I made a great point about the key not being the diet, but sticking to the diet. I've tried many different diets, from keto to
crickets,
just lowering my calories to a few different things, and it's always, I mean, consist. You can only lose so much weight per week. Consistency is really the thing that makes the difference when you're talking about losing dozens and dozens of pounds.
What about increasing calories out with fapping? Has that been helpful for you?
Yes, I find that.
Did you gain weight on no fap?
Yes, but I felt like that was a lot of like. You know, good weight, mostly muscle and the, you know, like extra testosterone in the body, things like that.
Hmm. Okay, well, thank you, and it's useful to have sort of that personal vignette. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, man, people have no idea what they eat though. That they really have to learn to get a sense of how much it is that they're eating, right? That's my take. If we're going to start thinking about how we're going to decrease 500 calories, okay, are we decreasing down to 6,500? I think it's a good idea to get a good understanding of what the patient eats on a day-to-day basis. What kind of diets have they tried? What works for them?
Absolutely.
What works for them?
I think that's...
Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but... Yeah, I think most people have no clue how many calories they're taking in, and by far and away, and this isn't meant to be cynical, but people will underreport how much they're eating, or you know, the typical response, again, not to be cynical, but it's just funny how predictable it is when you broach obesity as an issue. People will immediately talk about, oh, well, yeah, I've been trying to increase my exercise and been trying to get to the gym more. They won't talk about diet 95% of the time. And then when you bring up diet, they tend to underestimate the amount that they eat. So it's a really sensitive topic. And if your goal is helping these individuals, you know, lose weight, being a prick about it is probably not the most useful approach. But tiptoeing around the issue is likely not helpful either. So yeah, there are various, you know, things like apps like MyFitnessPal, for example, that's a free app for those who are a little more tech savvy that is useful for getting a sense of how many calories in. You know, there'll be people who talk, oh, yeah, and I do a little bit of nighttime snacking and they're eating a, you know, fucking, they're eating a bag of chips that are, you know, 700 calories. Like, so your point taken, quantifying calories in is super important.
Man, it goes the other way too, because when I first started lifting, in the first year I put on like over 40 pounds, and I was talking with this guy at work, and he said like, oh yeah, I'm trying to get into lifting as well, and I'm trying to bulk up, but my metabolism, you know, it's just so fast. I don't think I'm capable of gaining that muscle mass. And I said like, man, like, Your body is not breaking the laws of physics. Like, what are you eating in the day to day? He's like, oh, I eat tons. I'm like, what did you eat for breakfast today? He said he ate two toaster strudels. And that was his bulking diet. I'm like, yeah man, get my fitness pal, figure it out, and you'll set your BMI straight.
Excellent. So that's really useful in the framework as calories in, calories out, as being a literal, you know, principle in physics that's going to determine weight gain. So in terms of other supportive management strategies, emphasizing that even modest weight loss, like on the order of 5% of body weight, can have clinically significant outcomes. So for example, blood pressure is for me the one that I see most frequently. And you can quote folks that, you know, even a 5% weight loss for those in the obese category that is greater than 30 BMI, can decrease the systolic blood pressure by up to 5 points. So you can, with a fairly modest weight loss, potentially cure hypertension, and certainly effects on A1C or sugar level are also really rapidly achieved with incremental weight loss. So that's helpful. In terms of, you know, do we want to go into some other, you know, pharmacologic strategies, more promising medications than prior? Do we want to chat about that now, or did you guys have any other comments that you wanted to add?
Maybe just on the physical exam, some keywords to memorize as signs of hyperlipidemia, for example. So we want to recognize any corneal arcus, which would be like lipid deposit in the cornea from the hyperlipidemia. We could get lipemia retinalis, which is the, again, atherotoma seen in the retinal blood vessels in the eye. We can have eruptive xanthoma, where we get, there are these reddish, yellow, pruritic, and painful papular or nodular rashes. The skin is just exploding with fat at that point. We can have xanthoma on our tendons, so tendinous xanthoma, which are the deposits usually around the Achilles. Xanthelasmata, where it's, again, deposited underneath the skin, usually around the eyelids. It'll be a yellowish deposit of cholesterol. It'll be like tough and sharply demarcated. And that's some key words to remember as they might show up in a question stem.
Yeah, and I would just add acanthosis nigricans, is a hyperpigmentation, especially around the neck and armpits, and then also simple skin tags or papillomas. Those are two prominent features of insulin resistance, And you'll see them also on a lot of, and I, you know, what I'm tiptoeing around, I'm saying ethnic minorities, they're not necessarily a minority in your community. So you'll see them around, like a lot of South Asians and people of African descent can manifest those changes. And it is a reason certainly to look into problems with sugar. Interestingly, there are certain ethnic groups like Cajuns, French Canadians, who have familial predisposition to dyslipidemia, and the cholesterol deposits around the eyes are a prominent clinical manifestation there. So yeah, the point being is that in addition to getting them on the scale, measuring their blood pressure, measuring their height and potentially waist circumference, there can be other sort of physical manifestations of obesity.
And on that note, I'll quickly run through what the definition of metabolic syndrome would be. This is based on the International Diabetes Federation worldwide consensus. So I guess it's pretty important. So it's defined as central obesity, which if you're Chinese, Japanese, or South Asian patient, then it's above 90 centimeters waist circumference for men and 80 for women. And then for all other ethnicities, for men, waist circumference of over 94 centimeters, and for women of 80 centimeters, same as the Chinese, Japanese, South Asian group. So it's central obesity and two or more of the following. And we'll have thresholds for each of these. It's the hypertriglyceridemia, low HDL, hypertension, and elevated fasting plasma glucose. So to qualify for the hypertriglyceridemia, it's 1.7 millimoles per liter or greater serum value, or the patient is being treated for this abnormality in their blood work. To qualify as low HDL, less than 0.03 millimoles per liter for men, and for women, less than 1.29 millimoles per liter, or they're on a medication for this. Low HDL, as you may remember from your physiology classes, helps basically to round up the cholesterol from the organs in your body, helps metabolize them, brings them back to the liver to metabolize them, as opposed to our low density lipoprotein, LDL, which is a marker of a kind of the bad cholesterol, which whose purpose is more to deposit the cholesterol in your organs and various areas of your body. And then we have hypertension, systolic BP of 130 or more, or diastolic BP of 85 or more that qualifies, or they're on a medication for this or some sort of treatment. And then the fasting plasma glucose, 5.6 or more millimoles per liter or greater, or a previously diagnosed diabetes. That will be another one of our criteria. So central obesity plus two or more of those factors that will qualify you for metabolic syndrome. All right. So in terms of management, yeah, I guess we can get into the pharmacology. What do we have available in terms of drugs to help these patients out?
Concerta.
Concerta, yes.
Concerta, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
Adderall.
And yeah, and those will work. You know, stimulant medications are definitely appetite suppressing. Unfortunately, there isn't a primary indication I don't know if it's unfortunate, but there is not a primary indication for stimulant medications in terms of weight loss. But if you have comorbid ADHD, low IQ, like Dr. P, using those medications can be useful.
Probably jacks up their BP and puts them at risk for arrhythmias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the BP increase is fairly modest, but with clinical dosing of those stimulants, but yeah, on the order of sort of 3 to 5, which in a population obviously means some more heart attacks and strokes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fine for class 2 obesity, but not for extreme obesity.
So that's you know, incidentally, that's one medication that can promote weight loss. There are a few other medications. One is called Orlistat. I would say that it's really grown out of favor and is not used. What it does is it inhibits gastrointestinal absorption of fat. I think it's through lipase inhibition. And it causes steatorrhea, right? Like fatty, like nasty, stinky stools. It's not very commonly used. Contrave is a not infrequently used medication. So it's a combination of bupropion, which is Zyban or Wellbutrin by trade name, which is, I think, a DNRI, a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor.
That's it.
With naloxone, which is a an opiate antagonist. And the thought being is that in addition to suppressing appetite through the DNRI, Wellbutrin, it also inhibits the sort of euphoric reward of sinking your teeth into a double Big Mac. So I think it has some weak evidence. There is a medication with good evidence. Are two medications with good evidence. Anyone recall what those medications may be? So there's two. One is called Saxenda, which is a daily belly poke medication. And the other one is called Ozempic. Ozempic has only recently been approved. It's not even approved in our jurisdiction. But they're both a GLP-1 agonist used and have good safety profile from diabetes. And they're actually super effective. So they can promote really good weight loss, like 10% body weight loss in 6 months. Have a significant side effect profile, including nausea, which is usually associated with early satiety because it decreases gastric emptying, but that sometimes can be experienced as nausea, diarrhea or constipation, but I would say more commonly diarrhea, which is sort of interesting given that it decreases motility, but anyhow. And then there's two absolute contraindications. One is a history of medullary thyroid cancer, or a history of men, multiple endocrine neoplasia. So screen your patients for personal or family history of thyroid cancers and then subtype it, as well as recurrent pancreatitis. Those are the two absolute contraindications, but super effective medications. And I think we'll likely be seeing more and more of them, particularly in those with pre-diabetes.
Yeah, and I, in terms of some more dietary recommendations that we can make on top of the meds, we can talk about salt restriction, recommending lowering it to less than 2,400 milligrams of salt per day. Does have evidence for lowering our blood pressure, and when combined with the DASH diet, we can have further synergistic effect for even greater lowering. You'll be dizzy from how low it is. Alcohol is something we want to address. Less than 3 drinks a day for men, so a maximum of 15 a week. So we'll have to cut down. And less than 2 drinks a day for women, to a maximum of 10 a week, has evidence for decreased risk of hypertriglyceridemia, hypertension, certain cancers, as well as osteoporosis. You know, we can talk all day about different diets. DASH diet is a common one. Same with Mediterranean diet. Generally, these will help with blood pressure and lower LDL, the bad one, as well. And with omega-3s, they are associated with a decreased, sudden death risk, as well as death from coronary artery disease. And they help with lowering triglycerides as well. And that's with a recommendation of 2 or more servings a week of fish, in particular salmon, and especially oily fish. Lots of omega-3s there will help keep your heart pumping.
Excellent. So I think with that, We're equipped to help our patients lose weight. Don't accept that that they're doomed to a life of obesity. Reinforce that there is a simple but very challenging solution, which is decreasing calories in, and see them cure their hypertension, their diabetes, their or decreased knee osteoarthritis, among a plethora of successes associated with weight loss. So this is an important intervention for your patients. Okay, guys?
Okay, guys?
Yeah, and try to assess for how prepared they are for change. So there's that cycle of change that is taught in medical school. Are they in the pre-contemplative stage or contemplative? Are they thinking about, well, in pre-contemplative, they're not even thinking about making any change just yet. So in that instance, you may want to just bring up the fact that, hey, you know, you've been putting on some pounds. How about that? Maybe try to get the ball rolling. And then with contemplative, they're bringing it up. In that case, that's showing some motivation to change. So you can provide guidance on that and help bring them to the preparation stage, the third one. Try to put their thoughts into action with our fourth step and maintain them on that healthy road and support them during any relapses. Your approach will vary based on how motivated the patient is and how much research they've done, how, you know, have they gotten a gym membership? Are they developing a social circle that will help propel them along the maintenance phase that's going to bolster their psychosocial environment to help maintain that weight loss? Those are all things that you can chat about with the patient and see where the hangups are and see where you can try to help them out.
Beautiful. I love it. I think we're saving lives here, guys, by proxy. Any other final comments before we disconnect for this this week's episode of Elite Medical School?
Yeah, I think quitting smoking also might put on some weight, but will certainly help out with the cardiovascular.
Yes, cigarettes are a good treatment for obesity as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's thank you. That's an important final takeaway. Yeah, if all else fails,
I thought I should throw that in there.
Take up smoking.